if you're not with the right team, with the right people at the right time, it's not going to work.
Our guest today is Ty Majeski. He's a race car driver. He's also probably the best iRacer of all time, with 2 iRacing accounts over 10,000 iRating. In real life, he currently competes in the NASCAR Camping World Truck Series for Thor Sport. He made it to the Final 4 last year, almost winning the championship. The rest of his racing resume is just insane. He's won the Snowball Derby. He's won the Slinger Nationals multiple times. He's set the record for the most championships of any ARCA Midwest Tour guy, winning 5. He won the scholarship for the Alan Kowicki Driver Development Scholarship, and he was a Roush Development Driver, part of that program. So if you guys enjoy this podcast, if you know anyone who's going to like it, share it with some friends, give it a rating. It always helps. Enjoy. So yeah, last year you were working full-time, and now you're still working full-time for Thor Sport, who's the team you run for. And before we started recording, I was asking you, do you work on everyone's truck or just your own truck now that you're racing full-time for the team?
Yeah, so last year I was an engineer and I had to scan all the parts. My job was to take individual parts, so each upper control arm, spindle, rear end housing, chassis, and it all needed to get scanned and put into the whichever manufacturer with. Last year was Toyota, now it's Ford, into the directory, and we basically can build models of the truck with each individual component per the race team. So my job was to scan everybody's parts, not just my own. This year I've taken on a little bit more of a driving role, and I'll be, you know, specific to the 98 team and working with Joe and my engineer on building fast race trucks and making fast setups.
Right on. How you ran decent at Daytona. How did that go? That was last weekend.
Yeah, Daytona was okay. We had a fast truck. That truck was going for 3 poles in a row, one with Johnny Sauter, last year with myself, and this would have been 3 in a row. We missed it by just a little bit. Ended up second. The KBM trucks have a really strong super speedway program right now, so qualified second and had a really solid points day. You know, we kind of in the past have taken the strategy to run around in the back a little bit and stay out of trouble and maybe give up the stage points in order to get a good finish, but it never ends up going that way. So we decided just to race up front all night, and it worked out. We ended up, I think, 6th in each stage and ended up finishing 6th in the race. 3rd in points coming out of Daytona, going into Vegas. So can't complain about that.
Right. Yeah, I always wonder that, and I've never had the opportunity to run a super speedway yet. I'm planning on doing it at some point. But, you know, it's so conservative, but there's so many, you know, random variables. Like, can you really just run around at the back, or why not just go for it the whole time? I don't know. It's always, tough to think about.
I've seen it work both ways. We've seen a lot of trucks or drivers or teams win at Daytona or Talladega that maybe wouldn't ordinarily win, and they've done it by just being there at the end, right? So I think you can do it either way, but I think if you can stay up front and you're smart about it and you can stay inside the top 5, generally speaking, the most of the wrecks happen behind that. So if you have a fast enough truck to maintain your track position, I think, you know, with the fact that stage points are so important throughout the season, I think it's worth the risk to try and race up front, collect stage points. And if you collect good stage points and you get in a wreck going for the win at the end, you've already salvaged your day because of those stage points. So I think we're just going to go, you know, the reason I'll back up a little bit. The reason why we went with the strategy we did is as to your point, I don't have much experience on the super speedways at all. So Talladega is a playoff race for us. So I wanted to go into Daytona with the mentality of, okay, I need to make these moves, even if they're bad moves. And, you know, we end up, you know, getting freight trained while making an aggressive move that didn't work. I've got to learn what a good move is, when to make those certain moves, because we need to be on our game when we get to the second round of the playoffs in Talladega, because that can control our destiny, whether we get to race for a championship or not in Vegas.
Yeah, it makes sense. Makes sense. I mean, so much to learn over, you know, racing a whole season, racing those super speedways and so many different tracks. But man, let's introduce you to, or introduce the, what you to the world to you, a little bit, kind of build up your backstory here. Where were you born? Where'd you grow up?
Yeah, I was born in, I grew up in Seymour, Wisconsin. That's my hometown. So I'm a cheesehead Packer fan, and grew up racing there, racing go-karts in Wisconsin, dirt oval go-karts. Then moved up into asphalt late model racing in the Midwest and started traveling around the country once we started winning races regionally. And that's kind of where I was able to really build my roots in racing and win a bunch of races and sort of open my own opportunity to the next level.
Backing up, how did you get into motorsports? You know, it's always, everyone has their kind of unique story as to how they were first exposed and what, you know, why you ended up racing go-karts as opposed to whatever, quarter midgets or snowmobiles.
Yeah, snowmobiles would have been, you know, an obvious choice for us being in Wisconsin. But no, it's kind of a funny story. So I was about 8 or 9 years old at the time. I'll never forget it. I was sitting at a dinner table and with my family, so my sister and my parents. And I was at that age where all my friends were starting to go out for tackle football. And I wanted to, of course, join them. And I'm not a big guy now. I'm about 5'4", 140 pounds now. So you can imagine how small I was then. So my parents didn't want to go and have me getting hurt, right, playing tackle football. I was just a small guy. And we're always, you know, my dad was always a NASCAR fan growing up. We always watched NASCAR races. So, you know, we were, you know, NASCAR fans. And my dad's like, man, you know, what if I went out and bought you a go-kart instead of, you know, playing tackle football? I'm like, yeah, it sounds pretty cool. And I was always into the PlayStation 2, you know, NASCAR, you know, 04 and 05. I was always into it. And I started racing go-karts actually in 05. So that's just kind of how it all started. And always made sure to surround ourselves with good people. And, you know, because my dad didn't know much about it. I obviously didn't at that age. And so we just, you know, got the right people around me to help make me successful in each and every level I've been to.
So why, and it was dirt oval go-karts.
Yep.
Why? Was there like a track in town?
Yeah, so there was about 3 or 4 tracks within an hour of our house. So honestly, I don't exactly know how my dad settled on, you know, dirt go-karts. I think he heard of a track and we went to, it was in Cecil, Wisconsin, Heigl Raceway, just to watch, just to check it out. And we're walking around the pits and, you know, there was a racer's dad that was kind of watching us wander around a little bit. And he was, you know, asking if we were interested, and he got us hooked up with a local chassis dealer. And, his name was Dave Sincula. He was a dealer for Prowler chassis out of Florida. So we got hooked up with him and, got a new go-kart for, the next season and built it over the off season and went racing. It's raced out of the back of our pickup for, I think, 2 years. A lot of good times.
No, for sure. That was, you know, some of my most fond memories going go-kart racing with my dad.
Yeah, definitely.
So when did you get some success? Was it pretty quick, like, or did it take some time?
Yeah, it was decently quick. I think, I think I started racing in, I think it would have been June of 2005, and I won the day before my birthday that year in August. So, you know, about 2 months before my first win, and it was decently competitive. And, you know, I feel like, you know, once you win one, you're a kid and you expect to continually, you know, you want to keep doing that, right? And it wasn't realistic. So there was, I think the next season, actually, I didn't win at all. And then the season after that, I, you know, blew up and won 3 of the local go-kart championships. And And then moved up into national go-karts, I think in 2007, won a couple national championships in the Midwest, and then hopped into a late model.
So how did that jump happen? Like, that's a big jump, but everyone in go-karts ultimately has to make that jump unless you have a bazillion dollars behind you and you go each little, you know, incremental step. How did that jump happen from dirt go-karts to late model,
full-size
stock cars?
I'm glad you asked. So we were at a national indoor karting championship every year over Thanksgiving. It's in Mississippi. This particular year it was 2008 in Batesville, and it's kind of the big, I guess, off-season indoor karting championships every single year, and I think it's still going on to this day. And Bobby Waltrip, who was Michael and Daryl's brother, he was a commentator there. And that year, I won, this is 2009, not 08. So 2009, I won three of the five races in my class. And Bobby came up to us after the last race of the weekend and said, "Hey, you know, we think, you know, you have some talent. You know, we want to get you in a late model stock, and we want you to go, you know, test in North Carolina. I have a team set up." And so we went out and went to Hickory, North Carolina. I remember I didn't know how to drive stick. I was 15 years old at the time. No idea how to drive a stick shift. And my dad went out and bought like a $500 S10, those little Chevy pickups. And I'm running laps. We have like a U-shaped driveway, and then it goes onto the road so you can kind of make a circle. And so I'm out there just grabbing gears all day long, and in the wintertime, drifting around, grabbing gears, learning how to drive stick shift before my test in Hickory in February of that year. So it's just kind of funny, you know, going back and, you know, thinking about all those moments that led to where I'm at today. It's pretty cool. But yeah, I went out and tested that late model, and it went really well. They wanted us to, you know, put together a deal, and I think it might have been 10 or 12 races, and we just didn't want to move and relocate to Carolina at that time. So we got hooked up with the team out of Wisconsin. It was the team that actually Ross Kenseth, Matt's son, was racing for at the time, and got into a limited late model, ran limited late models in 2010, 11, and then moved up into a super late model in 2012.
So how did that's funny. Like, you obviously can't show up there and not know how to drive stick and embarrass yourself. So that's a great story. How did the test go? Were you quick? Like, they wanted to help you run, and what did that program look like? You know, and it would have been astounding if they were to fund the whole thing. Was it a big check that you had to bring, or were they going to really help you out in North Carolina?
You know, I don't know. I was, like I said, 15 at the time, and you know, my dad was really mostly handling all that. To my knowledge, I think we had to pay, and it wasn't a crazy amount. I don't think racing was quite out of control as it is right now. I mean, some of these rent-a-ride deals are just incredible what they're getting for them. But the team was actually Kiker Motorsports, and Brandon Dean was their current driver at the time, and he raced, you know, Hickory and maybe the, you know, late model stock tour around the Carolinas and Virginias, and actually Lee Pulliam then took over that program after Brandon Dean. Lee Pulliam's probably one of the better late model stock racers in the country. But yeah, so I was in the car and ran a bunch of laps, and then he jumped in it, and we were very close to the same speed. And I don't know if he was like going slow just to make us feel good about it, right? I didn't know, but you never know, right? No, they wanted us to come down and do a limited schedule, and like I said, I believe we were having to pay for it, to my knowledge, and instead we put together a little bit more regional level deal. I think it was a better stepping stone for me. Even, you know, I don't know that there was a small stepping stone going from go-karts to late models. Just, there's just so much different, obviously. So it was a big step. It was the learning curve for sure. It took me a few years to really get going, but one day it just clicked and started winning races.
So how come, you know, I guess how come you guys didn't want to move? Like, it was, I guess, still pretty early. And what were your parents, or what was your dad doing for work back home?
Yeah, so my dad is an engineer by trade, but he, wasn't in engineering for a while. He went, you know, on the business side of his company. His company designed and manufactured a lot of computer chips. So one of their biggest projects that they did was actually a project that everybody would know, was the, you know, the Coke machine that you can go and you can pick all the different flavors out. And I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, yeah. They designed the computer chip for that. And there's, and it's actually a pretty sophisticated machine. It basically, I don't know if you ever experienced this, if you go to different regions, like if you have a Mountain Dew in New York versus California, the mineral composition of the water is different and it might taste a little bit different. Well, that machine would, you know, sense that and make the composition of the water similar, so Coke would taste the same wherever you were at in the country, or whatever type of water you were putting into it. So, and then they were into a lot of, you know, hospital x-rays and hospital equipment and stuff like that. So that's what he was doing back home at the time. And we just didn't want to relocate, right? We were both in, you know, really obviously deep into school. My sister is 3 years younger than me, so she would have been 12 at the time. And I don't think my dad necessarily knew that it was worth it at that point. You know, I don't think he knew if I was good or not, right? There was a lot to learn about my development at that time. So I just don't think he wanted to take the risk to make that move to Carolina and wanted to stay in Wisconsin.
Right. So you guys run your limited late model, out of your own shop back home?
So it was a rental deal. So it was with the team that Ross Kenseth was racing for out of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. Okay. And they had I think they ran maybe three or four in-house cars at the time. Had a pretty good program, learned a lot from them. And we were with them from 2010 to 2012. And then I moved on from them in 2013. And the team I moved to, I'm still with today when I run my super late model. So been with them for, I guess this will be year 11 now.
Wow. So, you know, obviously you're known for winning a shit ton of super late model races and running all over the country. When did you hit that stride in the super late model?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of a couple of things. To answer your question, the year that really jump-started my career, we won. So the ARCA Midwest Tour Championship, or the ARCA Midwest Tour is the series, the main super late model series in Wisconsin, travels to the surrounding states, about 10, 11 races a year. So I won the championship in my rookie season in 2014, won, I think maybe five races total that year. We ran more than just those 11 races. We ran, you know, different specials and parts of different series, but, the Midwest Tour was the premier series. So, we won two Midwest Tour races that year and five total races, might've ran 30 races total. And in 2015, I applied to be a part of the driver, the Quickie Driver Development Program. And I got...
Explain that.
What's that?
Explain what that is for people.
So the Quickie Driver Development Program, the late Alan Quickie passed away in a plane accident on his way to Bristol. He was from Wisconsin originally, raced super late models, had a dream in NASCAR, literally just moved by himself to Carolina, wanted to start a race team. Did it, eventually became a cup champion as an owner, driver, crew chief, wore all the hats, right? A very historic figure in racing that maybe is not given the amount of publicity or praise that he deserves. What he did was truly the first person to really ever do it the way he did it. So a few of his, I'll say Quickieites, because that's what they call them themselves. Tom Roberts runs the program. Paul Andrews, which is part of his championship winning team, is on the board. And there's a handful of others. Tony Gibson, he was a crew chief at Stuart Haas for a while, worked with Alan in his championship season. So a lot of the Quickieites got together, wanted to make a driver development program. And basically it's, they take seven drivers, right? You can apply to it. They take seven drivers per year and they give you $7,777 to go race that season or put it towards whatever you want it to. And, the winner at the end of the year gets a grand prize of seven times that number. It ends up being 54,000 X amount of dollars. So the point system is based off of what you do on track and off track. So community service, right, representing Allen. There's just a number of things you can do. What I did was I started a driver development program similar to their program, but just at a lower level in go-karts. So I went back to my local go-kart track like we talked about before. Took seven drivers and had basically the same competition as I was competing in my competition. So it was kind of a neat idea and it worked out. And that whole program really launched me to really push myself on and off the track that season. I think we ran 40 some races, won over 20 of them. And that's really wow. The year that really kicked off my career. And then we followed it up the following season. Ran 54 races. We won 28 of them. And that's when I signed my driver development deal with Roush and then was a part of the NASCAR Next program with yourself. So it all just snowballed from 2015 in that Quickie program on.
Wow. Wow. You guys ran a lot of races.
A lot of races.
That's crazy. And a winning percentage that's, you know, unheard of. Man, so you're known for, among some guys, well, actually, you know, funny, when we first met in the NASCAR Next deal, when everyone was kind of being introduced, like, I didn't even know what NASCAR Next was, you know, and I was so far removed from the NASCAR scene and the late model scene and everything. And when you showed up, everyone was asking you these iRacing questions.
Oh, yeah.
and I had got on iRacing like a month before that NASCAR Next deal. You were like number one and two account in the world at that time. Like, let's just talk about that. When did you get on iRacing and when did you realize, hey, there's something here?
Yeah, so that's funny that you asked that. So actually, before I did that test, so back to the previous story we were talking about when Bobby Waltrip wanted me to do that test in Carolina. While I was driving that S10 learning how to drive stick shift, he's like, hey, you've got to get iRacing, right? And get, you know, just and run laps in a stock car. Even though it's not the same, you still get the proximity of where the wall's at versus where you're at, right? You get that vision of it. So I got on iRacing in 2000. That would have been 2010, like really early 2010. And, I bought this old steering wheel from a guy who did our ear molds. He was was a supplier of RE, and I was in was in his basement getting my ear molds done for that test. And he's like, "Hey, I saw that steering wheel sitting there." I'm like, "Hey, you know, where do you get one of those steering wheels? I'm looking at getting into iRacing." And he goes, "Hey, you can have it for $100." And I'm like, "All right, cool." So I gave him $100. Set it all up, and that is still the same steering wheel I'm using today. Yeah, crazy. So it's kind of a funny story, but so I started iRacing in 2010. It's hard to get going on there. There's a lot you just need to do it and figure it out, right? From the setups to you know, the settings and all the wheel, you know, everything really needs to be perfect to figure it out. And I got this setup for a late model stock in like 2012. And that something just clicked then. I just started winning a ton of races with that setup. It was a Martinsville setup. And I didn't know exactly like what I needed to do with the setup. But once I got a baseline, I was able to adjust it for each track. And then my iRacing career just took off from there. So it's just crazy how those little moments throughout your career, you go back and be like, man, that was the turning point, you know, and a big reason why I've made it to this point. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, you're certainly you know, it's iconic, your setup right now. Right. Like, you explain what you're working with, you know, in this day and age after COVID, everyone's got three screens, killer computer, you know, giant force, you know, giant direct drive wheel, Formula One style pedals. What are you working with?
So I just have, so that wheel I told you I just bought was just a used Logitech G27 wheel and pedals. And actually, I'm off my old iRacing laptop. I get about a new laptop because it peters out after about 3 or 4 years. So I get a new laptop. So I just race off of a laptop, that steering wheel. The reason I do it is because I know if I get an actual sim unit, I live in three different places. I had a house in Charlotte, my parents in Wisconsin, I'm in Ohio now, and I've always been that way my whole career. And I know from, you know, racing on other people's fancy sim rigs that you get used to it. And then you go back to your little one with a laptop and a steering wheel, and it takes you a bit to get back into it. So always being on the road, I can just fold down my laptop, and Logitech G27 wheels are very inexpensive. So I have three of those in my three different locations that I go to, and I can just easily go to each different place and have the same exact sim rig instead of having a fancy one somewhere and having to, you know, get used to my cheap one. So it's just the way it's worked out. But once I settle down somewhere, I'll probably get something nice.
Right. I've recently been on a pretty good one. I built one for my dad in his basement before he, you know, to give him some testing before he does some of the, he's doing some TA2 races. Okay, so he's down at Sebring right now.
I love TA2 but, cars.
Oh, me too. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. That would be, so yeah, it's worth his while, you know, way cheaper than a single test day to go have a serious setup that he can go learn some tracks and do that. So I've been driving that, and it's totally, my initial setup was almost the exact same as yours.
Right.
And to go back to that now would be so hard, especially on the road course stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really, really hard to react once you've had the taste of, you know, the feedback in the wheel.
Yeah.
That's a tough deal. Yeah. So how do you go back and forth between, like, say, a manufacturer sim and then your setup?
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. Yeah, we do a lot of sim, you know, through our manufacturers, and those are all out. I would say it's almost so much different that it doesn't mess you up. Like, I guess that's the best way I can explain it. You know, I'm not taking, you know, a late model that I at Martinsville that I run on iRacing on my you know, fancy rig, and then go back and run that same exact setup at the same exact track. You know, you're getting a rhythm with how you brake with a, you know, a real set of pedals, say, and force feedback and all that kind of stuff. And you go to something that's not like that. It's just so much different, like a totally different discipline, that it doesn't seem to affect me too much.
Right. Right. I was in the Toyota sim once, and it was astounding. Like, I always explained, people were like, what was it like? And I'm like, honestly, if you had, like, knocked me out and then I came to in the rig and we were running Mosport before the truck race, I'm like, I think it would have taken me almost a corner two to realize I wasn't in a real truck. Like, I wasn't in a real car. Like, the noise, the heat, it's insane in those things.
I know, it is wild how realistic they can get it, you know, and the way how far the tire models have come, and the visuals and the 3D glasses that you wear, just the whole thing is just phenomenal. It's incredible how far it's come, and we haven't seen, this is probably just scraping the tip of the iceberg.
Totally. So when did iRacing contact you?
So,
like, at what point?
Yeah. So when I became, so it was a big thing, like, when I was about to get to 10,000 iRating for you iRacers, it's kind of like, at that time I was getting close, and it was like uncharted territory. And actually, one of my buddies from iRacing emailed them and said, hey, this guy's getting, you know, close to 10,000 iRating. And they responded back, and they almost thought it was just going to stop at 9,999. Like, they thought that it was just going to stop, but it didn't.
Like Y2K.
Yeah, right. And that was going to be it. That was going to be, that's it. I beat the game. No, but So that's what they thought was going to happen. And they're like, geez, you know, they looked up my name and then reached out to me and said, hey, you know, this, you know, your buddy gave you my gave us your contact. We wanted to reach out. And they knew the off season going into 2015. They were on my car for the first time in February of 15 at Speed Weeks. And, I remember, you know, just putting the deal together, and man, it was just so cool to put that iRacing logo on the car. I remember I was just so pumped about it. They've been with me. We just did another, you know, just our late model deal with them again. They were on my first Xfinity race with Roush Fenway in 2017. They were on a couple of my truck races with Nice in 2020. So they've been a huge supporter of mine on and off the racetrack. It's good to have good people supporting you and a great product like that.
How many hours were you putting in a day or a week, like in your peak,
ooh,
in your prime?
I don't know that I want to even say.
I think the people have to know.
Oh, man, I don't even – it's hard to put. I remember I would, you know, in college, I was in my dorm room, and I had my bed was – and my dorm was on top. And then underneath my bed was my desk with my iRacing steering wheel. And I know I would get done with class, and I'd go and iRace. And that was really in – I think – I don't remember what year I actually got to 10K, but I'm pretty sure I was in college at the time. So that would have been in like 13 or 14, that would have been 14 or 15 time frame. And I was doing a lot of iRacing then, and enough to get two accounts to 10,000 and well over it. So I don't know. It was a lot of hours a week. I know I would get back from class about 5:30, 6 o'clock. And if I didn't have much going on, I was on until about 11, probably five times a day. So it was in my prime. I was into it, man. It was a lot of fun. I don't regret any of it looking back at it. I'd met some great people. You know, I think that's the thing that maybe people don't realize about iRacing is the people you can meet on there. I made, you know, really big contacts with Dale Jr., Brad Keselowski, TJ Majors, just through iRacing. And everybody in the racing community, most probably have iRacing in some way, shape, or form, or have done it. It's just a tightly knit family, and you just never know who you're going to run into on there. I've gotten countless sponsors, and like I said, I just name drop those guys. Just the people that you meet on there, it certainly shaped my career, not only from a driving perspective, but just from a networking perspective as well.
Right. Right. So jump ahead now, you know, you have this banger year in 2014, 2015. We're in the NASCAR Next deal. Now again, you're, I guess, beyond iRacing, you're formally introduced to the NASCAR world, having never done a NASCAR race still, just running late model stuff. How does the Roush deal come about and explain what that is?
Yeah, so originally, the guy who really fired off that relationship, was Gary Rulo. He owned and ran Rulo Brothers Racing. They won the championship with Chris Buescher. They were an ARCA series team. They won the championship with Chris Buescher, I think in 2011 or 2012, right around that time frame, and they were a Roush affiliate. So had a lot of contacts with Roush Yates, where they got their engines from, and they actually ran some of their cars came out of Roush's shop, even though they were located in the Chicago area. And I was at it was Slinger Nationals of 2015. I didn't qualify real well. We had to actually take a provisional to get into the race. This Slinger Nationals, for those of you that don't know, is probably the Midwest's biggest race of the year. It's a little quarter mile bull ring. It's always a Tuesday night race, attracts NASCAR drivers. Matt Kenseth has won, I think, 7 or 8 of them. Kyle Busch has won there, right? The list goes on and on. And I had to start in the back, and Gary Rulo was there just watching the race. And I came from, like I said, had to start in the back with taking a provisional. It was a 200 lap race. I ended up getting up into second, and I was running down the leader with, like, it was under 15 to go, and I was, the sense of urgency was high because it was going to be tight for me to catch him. So I actually spun out a lapper, not on purpose, but trying to, you know, I didn't want to go to the outside of him, right? I wanted to get to the bottom of him. So I spun him out, had to go to the back, and didn't win the race. I think I finished fourth or fifth or something. And he came up to us after the race and said, "Hey, we need to talk." And I didn't know who this guy was. He basically name dropped me to Roush, and he was sort of the middleman. He set up a meeting with Jack and some of the other higher ups at Roush Fenway at the time. Set up a meeting. We put a driver development deal together. It was basically a 2-year development deal, and they could pick up my option to sign me to a contract at any point. So that was in 2016, and in that contract, I was going to run, I think, 5 or 6 races with the Rulo brothers that season. So fast forward to 2016, the summer months, my first ARCA race with Rulo brothers was at Madison. I think it was probably June-ish. And I think we finished 4th. And then we went to Chicago. That was the time where all the new composite bodies were coming into ARCA. Gary just had a Rulo Brothers just had a steel body. So for those of you that don't know, the composite bodies are substantially better than the steel bodies. We went out and finished 6th at Chicago with a steel body car. And after that, Roush actually picked up my contract and signed me to an actual driver's agreement. So that contract was a 7-year contract. And it was, you know, assuming I was going to be in Cup after year 4, obviously that never happened. There's always ways out of these, right? You sign long-term deals. Everybody's got ways out, right? It's just kind of the way the world is. So you sign these contracts, and it's cool. It was really cool at the time, and it really got me in the NASCAR funnel, and it was my first real opportunity. I ran those ARCA races in 2016, worked in the shop full-time for them in 17 as a shot guy. At Roush Fenway, and then ran, I believe, 5 ARCA races that year in 17 and 3 nationwide or Xfinity races at the time. And 2018, then I ran 12 races with the infamous Program 60, which was pretty much a catastrophe. Right. So that was kind of my tenure with Roush, and that was my first real opportunity. And even though it didn't go well, I certainly learned a lot and gave me a lot of lessons and turned me into the driver and person I am today.
So when you signed that contract, the actual contract, in your mind, if you go back to that time where you're like, "Hey, I'm going to Cup. Yeah. I'm going to be driving. I'm going to be a Cup racer for Roush."
I mean, I thought there was a really good chance of that. And I knew at the time Roush's equipment wasn't maybe where they wanted it to be. And they were vocal about that. They knew that. And, you know, I felt like, you know, between Ford's support, because Ford was a huge part of the Program 60, almost single-handedly funding that entire program for Chase Briscoe, Austin Cindric, and I. And it just didn't work.
Explain to people who didn't watch that season. So it's Xfinity. So it's the Saturday night. It's the second level, you know, not the highest level. And this car was split between you three young guys and Ford guys. And this was like a development program, right?
Correct. And what was interesting about it is we each kind of had our separate ways. So a lot of people looked at it as a competition, and it wasn't that at all. I had my avenue through Roush. Chase had his avenue through Stuart Haas. And of course, Austin had his through Penske. So we really weren't competing for anything, but we're all young guys, right? And we all had talent to get to that point, right? We all could do it, right? We all wanted to beat each other, right? We all wanted to outperform the next guy, right? Naturally. And I think it was a combination of us really trying too hard and trying to prove ourselves when maybe we just weren't ready to do that. And also with where Roush's Xfinity program was at the time. And we were just I was trying to, you know, take a maybe a 12th or 13th place car and finish in the top five with it. And we got ourselves in trouble. And I don't know how many incidents. I remember seeing a graphic somewhere, and it was just we averaged over an incident a race in that car, meaning a spin, just some kind of accident of some sort. It was just a bad deal, and it just did not work. And so they, you know, Chase went on to run full time for Stuart Haas the following season. Austin at Penske, and Roush actually shut down their Xfinity program. So after 2018, I was basically out of a job.
Right. So it was I guess there was no opportunity for them to take you to Cup. That season didn't go well, and they just said, all right, you know, we're parting ways.
Yeah. So basically in the contract, it stated I had to run two races the first year. I believe it was, I want to say it was 10 the second year, which would have been 2018, the program 60 year. I ended up running 12, and the following year it was in the contract. I had to be full time. And after year two, there was basically an out for each side. So that was their time to either find a sponsor and put me in a car, which they were trying to do, or if they couldn't find a sponsor, they either were going to fund it or fire me. So they decided that, you know, I think there was a lot of factors going into that. First of all, I don't think that I did well enough. I didn't perform well enough. And second of all, I think they weren't performing how they wanted to on the Cup side. So I really think they wanted to take all those assets from the Xfinity side, focus on getting their Cup program where they needed to. So I think it was a combination of things, and it wasn't a bad breakup by any means. I still talk to a lot of those guys today, and I secretly still root for them. They're the ones that gave me my first big chance, right? They paid me to drive a race car. I didn't have to bring any funding, right? There's, for a guy like me, that those opportunities are few and far in between. So for them to have taken that chance on me, I'll forever be thankful for that. So no bad blood there. Just the timing wasn't right.
For sure. Now, were you in college at the time?
Yeah. So I was in college in 2014, 2015, 2016. When I signed the deal, I moved to Charlotte. I dropped out of college. So I actually don't have my engineering degree. I was always going to go back and if I needed to, but I just wanted to put everything I had into being a race car driver, because I felt like I wasn't bringing a check. So I feel like I had to set myself apart from everybody else in some way other than money. And my way of doing that was being all in by working at the shop, right? Being the simulator driver, right? In my tenure with Roush, I was in the simulator 2-3 times a week because the Cup guys weren't big on it. So I was the sim guy for them. So there was a lot of stuff I did behind the scenes to really set myself apart. And I felt like I couldn't go to college and do that at the same time. So I made the decision to not finish college and go all in on being a race car driver.
Right. And I'm assuming, but you know, your parents were cool with that.
Yeah. I mean, they were, I mean, it was some serious conversations, right? It was something that was going to shape my life, good or bad. Right. If it didn't work out, got to go back to school and finish and have a normal job. Thankfully so far, it hasn't turned out that way. I'm still keeping my head above water some years barely, but no, it's been a great ride, roller coaster ride for sure. And but yeah, we made the decision together to make the move to Charlotte, and me and my girlfriend at the time got an apartment just outside of the Roush race shop on Concord Mills there in Charlotte, and just made the big leap.
Right. So that deal ends, and I'm assuming you don't have any prospects for the next season. How did that feel? Like, you seem like a pretty happy-go-lucky guy, pretty optimistic guy. And I guess you still have your super late model that you can race. So was it hard when that deal ended, or was it put my head down and go to work?
It was disappointing, but I felt like with how the previous season went, you know, it would have been really hard, even if I was full-time, to really turn that program around within the off season, right? And I always wanted, I don't want to say I didn't have fun at Roush, right? Because I did, and I learned a lot. But I'm accustomed to going to the racetrack under the assumption I have a chance to win, right? Yep. And if I can't do that, it's not as fun for me. I just, and there are guys that can go to the racetrack and do the start and park deal, right? And make a living driving a race car, and they're okay with going to the racetrack and not having a chance to win. And that's great, right? I just can't do that. I can't do it. I'd rather go back, have a normal job than go to the racetrack and not have a chance to win. That's just my mentality, right or wrong. That's just how I am. And I'm just so competitive from that standpoint. And it was disappointing at the time, but I knew if I could land on my feet that there could be some potential for something better. And what happened was I obviously, like you said, always had my late model program, ran a bunch of races that year. We hit on a really good package in 2019 on our late model program. I think our winning percentage, I didn't run many races, but our winning percentage was just crazy that season. I think it might've been 12 for 16 races or something. And we went to, I'm trying to think how this went. So early in 2019, when I got fired from Roush, Ford wanted me to still work for them. So I actually signed a contract with Ford, the manufacturer, obviously. And I was their sim driver, and I was the backup wheel force car tester. So the wheel force car is a cup car that has $400,000 of sensors on it per wheel. So you don't want to wreck this thing.
Whew.
Yeah. So this thing, it would sense, you know, slip angles and tire deflection. And it was basically to collect tire data for the manufacturer. So each manufacturer has one. I think at the time, David Reagan, I think he still is the wheel force driver. And I think for Toyota, it was, I'm trying to think who it was. It's slipping my mind, but a big job. So I never actually got to drive the wheel force car, which was maybe good or bad. It would have been cool to do, but a lot of pressure. But I did do a lot of sim for him that year. I picked up 6 ARCA races with Chad Bryant Racing in 19. Won Charlotte, Pocono, and Chicago. Finished 2nd at Michigan, 4th at Talladega. It might have been it. And I did 1 truck race with Nice Motorsports at the end in 2019. So, won those 3 ARCA races early on in that season. I get a text from Phil Gold, who was the crew chief at, Nice Motorsports at the time. Phil Gold was Ryan Reed's crew chief at Roush when I was his teammate. So I knew Phil.
Okay.
And he knew I was kind of out of a ride, and they were in a position where they needed a driver to fill in some races. It was supposed to be 7 races at the time. It fell through. Kyle Benjamin came in, brought some money to the program. He ended up doing those races. They threw me in 1 race at the end of 2019. It was Phoenix, the race before the championship. At the time, Ross Chastain was running full-time, running for a championship with Nice, won a bunch of races that year. We went out, we qualified 5th and ran 10th at Phoenix. Ross was moving on, and Al signed me to a full-time deal shortly after that for 2020. And that's kind of what propelled me into my next opportunity. So 2019 was a very slim on the NASCAR side, 1 truck race, 5 or 6 ARCA races, and late models.
Right. Right. So let's jump to that Nice deal. Now it's your first opportunity to go race for a championship in NASCAR.
Yeah, I thought it was a great opportunity. The team's coming off of a 4-5 win season. Right. Finished 2nd in the championship with Ross. I thought I was in a really good spot. So a couple different things happened. So during the time Nice was transitioning from a GMS affiliated team, and they started hanging their own bodies, building their own chassis in-house. During that time, going from a truck and a half to two truck team to basically a four truck team. So I think that.
I think I'd call it a one truck team.
Yeah. I mean, there was four trucks going to the racetrack. So there was, it was just, you know, I don't know how to put this because I like the guys at Nice, right? And they, again, I didn't have to bring any money to this program, right? But I think that it was a lot to take in for one off season, right? You're starting to hang all your own bodies, build all your own chassis, add two teams, right? It was just a lot. And they were really big on practicing, and that's what Ross and Phil were really good at, was practicing and dialing their truck in. 2020 happens. We go to Daytona, end up on my lid, go to Vegas, had a decent run at Vegas, qualified third or fourth, ran in the top 10. COVID hits, right? Now we're off for a month and a half, 2 months. Come back. Okay, there's going to be no practice, nothing, right? I'm going to racetracks I haven't been to. To this point, I've only really run those 12 races with Roush, couple ARCA races. So even though it was my third or fourth year in the game, I maybe have 20 races total, and a lot of them were on the same racetrack. So I'm going into 2020 with a team I felt like maybe bit off more than what they could chew. And me not having any experience at a lot of these racetracks, it just was not the right timing. I don't think it was anything they did. It wasn't anything, you know, it just wasn't the right time with where they were at and with where my experience level was at. And it just didn't work. Once we fast forward to September of that season, ran very mediocre all year. The last playoff race, or the last regular season race, was Darlington. This was September. After we basically ran the regular season and didn't make the playoffs, they put Trevor Bain in my truck and let me go.
Did that hurt your confidence, or did you go, watch what this guy's going to do? Like, you know, it's not me.
I think throughout the season, Ross ran part-time, and, you know, he's like, man, this stuff just isn't what it was last year, you know? And I'm not saying that I was as good as him, because I don't think I was. He would, you know, I felt like he could get the most out of that equipment. And when he would show up and run, he was nowhere near where he was the year before. So I knew that it necessarily wasn't me, but unfortunately we're in racing, it's a lot of how people perceive an opportunity, right? So last year he goes out and almost wins a championship, wins five races. I get in it and I'm flopping like a fish all year, right? So that's how it's perceived by everybody. And, you know, I thought after 2020, I was like, all right, I'm going to give this off season, you know, try and find a sponsor, right? Try and land on my feet somewhere. If it doesn't work out, my dream is to be a NASCAR driver, right? And race for a living, but you've got to be realistic about it. You can't just keep going down a rabbit hole that just isn't realistic. And I felt like I'm a pretty realistic guy and a pretty matter of fact guy. And I kind of came to terms with that. And I was okay with putting all my effort in, trying to land on my feet for 2021. And if it didn't work out, I was just going to go race late models and go back and be a regular guy.
Yeah. Yeah. To back up to that, that truck season. Did you listen to Justin Marks on Junior's podcast?
I did not. No.
He had a good point, because I guess he raced a season of trucks when he was pretty young, and he put it together, and maybe you can relate to this. Maybe it's because you've done so much iRacing and you did all that stuff for Roush, it doesn't hit for you, but it really hit for me. He was like, I didn't know how to drive the thing. Like I did however many races, and I just didn't understand the truck. Like I was just over driving it, and I felt like when I jumped from our Canadian NASCAR to the truck, you know, bias ply tires to radial tires, truck arm, you know, that what I know now, like, I can't believe I even drove the truck like that. Was that the case, you know, for you a little bit? Are there things that you know now that you look back and you go, man, I really could have done better during that season?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, again, I was always getting compared to Ross that season, and rightfully so. I'm not blaming anybody for that, because that's the right thing to do. I think that I was probably trying to, again, the same thing at Roush. I was probably trying to overperform where the truck was capable of running, and whether that was, you know, the lack of communication on my part with the crew chief, or that was, you know, the equipment, or it was my experience level, my feedback, whatever it was, I was trying to, you know, overperform for where we were going to run that day. I got myself in some bad spots, and we ran very mediocre. I don't know how many top tens we had that season. It might have been 4 or 5. Not very good. And, you know, it's just crazy to go back and think about all the different factors that played a role in that. The trucks are so much different, require you to be so aggressive, because the trucks create so many runs. The runs are so big. And I don't know that I was confident or ready for that change from how the Xfinity and ARCA cars raced compared to the trucks. You really just have to race like an ass in the truck series. That's just what you have to do. You got to throw the blocks. You got to make the quick moves that's going to piss the guy off. And that's just how you have to race them. And that's how you maintain track position, because it's hard to pass. And dirty air is so bad with how big and bulky the trucks are. They poke such a big hole in the air. You've got to gouge and claw for all the track position you can get. And that doesn't mean just on the racetrack. That's coming in and out of pit road. Your pit crew needs to be good. There's so many factors that go into that. And I just think I wasn't ready to perfectly execute on all levels the way I needed to be successful in the truck series at that time.
Right. So now, for a second time, you're out of a ride. You've made this ultimatum with yourself. Hey, I'm going to give it one more shot. I'm going to, you know, do whatever it takes. Tell us where that goes.
This is a good one. So this leads to where I am today, right? Wrapping it all up. So Rulo Brothers 2016, right? My first ARCA race is when I first signed my Ford driver development deal, or Roush driver development deal. David Pepper was the spotter, okay? So David Pepper is the GM of Thor Sport right now.
So where you're at right now.
Where I'm at right now. So September of 2020, right, after Darlington, I get fired from Nice. I'm like, man, I was close with Chase Briscoe. We became friends during the program 60. I'm like, hey, man, you got, you know, these guys just fired me. You know, you have David Pepper's number? And he goes, yeah. He texted it to me, and I call Pepper. I'm like, Pepper, I know I hadn't talked to him really since, you know, he spotted for me at the end of 2016. And I said, Pepper, I know you guys don't have anything, you know, but, you know, I just got fired, and I don't feel like I was given a fair opportunity. And I said, you know, I'd love to have the opportunity to just come and check out the shop and build a relationship with you guys and just see where it goes. He's like, oh yeah. You know, if you want to come up and on your way back from Charlotte to Wisconsin, Ohio's a little bit out of the way. You know, next time on your way back, you know, just shoot me a text and stop in. Well, I wasn't going back to Wisconsin, but I was in Ohio the next week.
Yeah.
Right? You know, yeah, I'm going back to Wisconsin. So I'm up in Ohio the next week, right? and they show me around the shop, and we run into Duke Thorson, who is the team owner. Stop by his office, chat with him for 20, 25 minutes. Made it very clear I was interested, felt like I haven't been given a fair shot, you know, shared my Midwest values. I know he's from Minnesota. And he's, you know, I race against Johnny Sauter a lot on the late model side. So he knew of me from racing against Johnny. Johnny has been one of his drivers for years. And so he knew of me and stuff. And he's like, yeah, you know, I don't know what we have now, but we'll keep you in mind. I'm like, all right. So I go back and run some late model races in, you know, September, October, November 2020, December of 2020, we go down to the Snowball Derby. Biggest super late model race in the country every single year. We go and we win. And a few days later, Pepper calls me. Hey, we don't have anything full-time for you right now, but Duke really wants you up here. We want to give you an offer to come up here, work as an engineer, be the engineer on your own truck. We're going to give you a handful of races per year. And if it goes well, some of our other drivers, you know, we might have an opening within the next few years. A few years, you know, two or three, you know, maybe longer than that, right?
Yeah.
At the time, I had another opportunity I was working on with another team in the truck series. It would have put me in more races that season for 2021. Mm. It was like maybe 7 to 10 races with the option of not the option with like two or three Xfinity races on top of that. And I was going to have to bring money and have funding for those. And we had it, or most of it. And I decided, I'm like, man, you know, I just, how long is it sustainable? Right. You battle this, right? How long can you sustain bringing X amount, $100,000 per year to do 7 or 10 races? And can I get it to 2 million to make it a full season? Right.
Yep.
I'm like, man, you know, I just think my opportunity at longevity in the sport, I felt better about coming up here to Thor Sport. So I took the deal. No contract, right? There's very old school, but just really good people up here. So I took the risk to basically put racing on hold for a year. Only ran 4 or 5 races. It was actually 4. It was Charlotte, Nashville, Gateway, and Pocono was the 4th one. And ran my late model, of course, simultaneously. So I'd travel back, run my late model in Wisconsin, be back at work for Monday, drove through the night I don't know how many times after Sunday races to get back for work right away on Monday morning. And that's just what I did for a year. And we had a couple top 10s at Charlotte. I think we finished 8th at Charlotte, 7th at Nashville. Was running in the top 5 at Gateway with a chance to win. Got in a wreck on the front stretch late in the final stage. And the timing was just right. One of their other drivers, there's basically a seat open. And, you know, basically put me in the truck for the 2022 season. And rest is history.
Right on. So 2022 season, what do you have, 3 wins?
Two
wins?
Yep, 2 wins.
2 wins. You make it to the final 4. Like, you're doing it now. Like, do you feel, or did you feel that you got some redemption?
Yeah, no doubt about it. I think for those people that were really just specifically NASCAR fans, didn't know me from what I've done on the short track ranks, you know, to them, I was just a joke, right? I mean, I get this opportunity with Roush that was supposed to work out, you know, wrecked a bunch of stuff there, went to Nice, wrecked a bunch of stuff there, right? And seemingly a really good ride. And you know, to these people, I'm just, you know, and maybe to some people in the industry that didn't know me, right? They're like, geez, this guy, you know? And I really wanted, I felt like with the experience level, with the right amount of experience and the right opportunity with the right race team at the right time, I knew I could be successful. And I think that's maybe something that some people don't understand about racing is you can be completely capable of winning a cup race or an Xfinity race or a truck race, but if you're not with the right team, with the right people at the right time, it's not going to work. And on the same token, you can you can take the best team, the best truck, and if the driver isn't ready, it's still not going to work. So it goes both ways. You have to have all of it.
The timing that it takes to be successful, it takes some doing, and I think like it does take some time. You know, the armchair racer or the guy watching on the couch, I don't think really appreciates how hard it is to line everything up and win.
Yeah, and that's the thing, and especially on a consistent basis, because you're always going to be racing somebody at that level that has that kind of chemistry and equipment, right? There's always somebody or multiple teams that are going to have that cohesiveness. And that was something that I felt like with me being here at the shop, for being the first time working together with this team, I was able to accelerate that learning curve throughout the season. And we got better and better each and every race, and our communication got better. And we got to the point where we were winning races at the end of the year, and had a chance to win the championship with under five to go at Phoenix. And that's all you can ask for.
Yeah. I was rooting for you. So now you're doing it again this year. Do you have like a 5-year plan, 10-year plan? Obviously you want to be a cup racer.
Yeah. Yes and no. And that answer might surprise you. I think over the course of my career and being in Charlotte and living that that life, because I was, you know, being in Xfinity and being with a Cup team, you know, I was racing Xfinity for that team, but it was with a Cup team. So I'm in the shop every day, seeing how it works, right, from the business side, from the commitment side, from just the duties that you have to do to be a Cup driver. I was all in on doing that. I still would be today, but it is far from what you and I know is racing, right? That's, you know, scaling your car and loading up at midnight, right, to make it to the racetrack, you know, cutting clips off and adjusting control arm mounts and all that. You know, it's just so much not racing, right? It's you show up to the racetrack, you take care of your sponsor obligations, and you know, you go through all the motions, and you know, you get out of your sponsor appearance and change into your suit, and you're in the car, and you don't even, like, a lot of the drivers don't even know what they're even driving. And I would do that. It's always been my dream, and I'm not saying that I wouldn't. But it would take one hell of a deal to peel me away from where I'm at right now. These guys are, you know, Duke and Rhonda are great to work with. The team I have is phenomenal. I'm 6 hours from my house in Wisconsin. I can go race my late models. It's 23 weekends out of the year, you know, and I'm making a living driving race cars, and I can't think of a happier time in my life than what I am right now. So I'm having a blast with these guys, and just really happy to be here. And like I said, it would take some crazy, probably unrealistic opportunity to peel me away from this.
Right. I can appreciate that for sure. You know, one, I guess being close to home, and then, Yeah, it's totally a different deal. And I think what's changed, you know, because no one would expect someone to say, I want to race only in the Xfinity series or only in the truck series. Whereas a little while ago, whatever, 10, 20, 30 years ago, that was totally normal to do.
Yeah.
Right. And now I think what's changed it is guys coming in with huge funding and, you know, trying to use it as a ladder system, and ultimately really focusing on Cup and renting a ride every step of the way, staying with a team for only 1 year or 2 years, yep, and then moving on. Whereas I guess in your stable there, a guy like Matt Crafton has done it forever, and that's totally a pretty good template to try and mold yourself to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Duke has been, he's the longest tenured truck team in the series. So he's been around forever. He knows how to do it and do it right and be successful. And he's a great guy to drive for. And he's a super loyal guy. And, And I feel like, you know, I'm making sure I do the right things to be successful and make the most of the opportunity he's giving us, and trying to get the most out of what the team is providing us, and trying to perfect it each and every week. And it's been a fun ride so far. And you know, like I said, it's great for me being, you know, back, you know, I guess Ohio isn't the Midwest, but it's close. So it just logistically, it makes sense for me. And like I said, the thing about with teams in Charlotte, and I won't speak for all of them, but maybe the teams that I was with, you know, it's a 7 to 4 or 5 o'clock job, right? When business hours were over, there'd be a traffic jam getting out ready to go home. Here, we're a NASCAR team, but it is a short trek mentality. Like, all these guys here in the shop, like, we have a senior group of crew chiefs, but we have a lot of mid to low 20s
wow.
guys that work in the shop, right, that go race their dirt car out here in Ohio on off weekends. And like, we are just racers up here, and it's the people here work here because they want to go racing, not because it's a job for them to do. And I think that's the biggest difference between our culture here and some of the teams that I've been around in Charlotte. And that's another reason why it's just, I enjoy getting up and coming to the shop every single day. Just good people with good work ethic, and we all have the same goal, and we're going to work until the work is done. And we'll be on the pull down till 10:30, 11, 12 o'clock, whatever it takes to make sure we show up to the racetrack with our best chance to win. And that's something that's easy to rally around when you're here.
Right. No, for sure. And that must feel good as the driver.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. I got to ask you, because you've certainly been around the block with the late model stuff and the super late model stuff, and you've seen your fair share of competitive cars, let's say. And if you listen to Junior's podcast, I steal this question from him for every race car driver. What's the best or top few or most goofy kind of cheating stories or innovation stories that you've got? Doesn't have to be you. It could be someone you know.
Yeah, there's been a few of them. I'm with one of the best ones right now, Joe Shear, my crew chief. He's been around the ringer. No, there's some cool stories. So I'll go with my late model crew chief, Toby Noodleman. We've been together, like I mentioned before, 11 years now. This is our 11th season together. Previously, he was actually worked at Menards Racing. So Charlie Menard and Paul Menard used to have late models that they raced up in Wisconsin, and unlimited budget, right?
Yep.
Whatever they needed, they went for it. So Toby was given basically just, hey, make these things as best as you can make them. So he was telling me the story how he had motorized lead ballast, and he took a motor from a windshield wiper and actually had it threaded, and basically he can move lead from right to left after tech. So, and he was showing me how he did it, had a little switch and everything. Obviously highly illegal, and he never got caught, but yeah, they had some pretty innovative stuff back in the day when he was racing with Menards. Just with a budget like that, man, you can just have free reigns to do all that, so he can let the imagination work.
Wow, that's crazy. A little electric motor, eh?
Yeah, and you would never know it. You'd have to basically take the lead out and cut it in half. Like you'd have never even known it was there. Yeah.
Right. Cool. All internal. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty neat.
I see you sometimes outspoken on Twitter, and I think we're probably cut, maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but cut from a similar cloth, in that you would rather see a good, hard race as opposed to someone just getting dumped in the wall for the win.
Yeah, there's been some questionable, and I feel like it's it's really going more that direction. I feel like the more we get drivers in the seats that have never had to experience working on their own equipment, I think they lose maybe respect for who has to build them and work on them and fix them. They know, right, if they make a move like that and destroy their car, they just go to bed and come back, you know, and hang out with the guys at the shop if that's what they do, and head to the next race, and they don't even think anything of it. And I think between that and just it's just evolved in such a way, you know, with the way NASCAR's rules are, it just promotes winning and whatever you have to do it. And there's not a lot of penalty for those actions. And I think with the combination of all those things, we've just seen some things I wouldn't be comfortable with doing on the racetrack. And, you know, I play this back in my head. You know, I go back to Phoenix racing for the championship, right? I'm the lead guy on four tires with under five to go. My teammate Ben Rhodes, I have a run on him coming down the backstretch. Coming into turn three, I have a huge run on him. He throws a big block at me. I have two decisions. I can go and toss him into the corner or lift. And I think maybe I'm the champion if I don't lift, but I could not risk. Ben's my teammate. I cannot risk wrecking both of our trucks and ruining both of our chances at a championship for Duke. I didn't want to take that risk, even though I might have been able to just move him out of the way and I would have won the championship. And that would have obviously been, you know, what I wanted to happen, but it also could have ended up with us both wrecked. So I decided to lift, and I think about it a lot, and I maybe regret it a little bit, but because you don't know how many chances you're going to have at racing for a championship, right? I'm in a good spot, good opportunity, but it's hard to make it to Phoenix. No matter how good you run during the regular season, all it takes is, you know, getting caught up in the big one at Talladega, right? That's in the second round of the playoffs, right? It just takes one little, you know, speeding penalty or mistake on pit road or one bad restart, and that's, you know, no matter how good of a season you can have, you might not make it there. So you always want to take advantage of those opportunities, but I just could not get myself to do that. And I don't know that it's going to get better. It's probably going to get worse before it gets better, unfortunately. It's just the world we live in.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, you look at, you and I race, you know, little short tracks, and you look at the Clash in LA, and it's like, holy cow, these guys are just wrecking every other lap. Like, how are you? There's half the race is under yellow.
I know. It's incredible. And, you know, obviously that track promotes that kind of racing. And, you know, obviously the one instance I'm thinking of is the Xfinity race at Martinsville. It was hard for me to watch. I don't know about you, but I cringed when I saw it. I'm like, oh my gosh. You know, it's just like, I don't know. Just a lot of respect goes out the window when you see something like that happen. You know, no matter how talented the driver is that does something like that, it's just tough. You know, I've made some mistakes, but I I've been aggressive at times. We all have, racing for wins. But boy, I don't know that I could ever get myself to do something intentional like that. That would be, it's tough. It was hard to watch.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Couple high speed questionable moves last year anyways. I think a lot of times, you know, when people are talking about you, talent, like the word talent comes up, but I don't think people realize, you know, how many hours you've put into it, and hard work, whether it be iRacing or your late model program, like insane amount of hours, insane amount of races, virtual and real. What advice do you have for a young guy who's in go-karts or in a late model and wants to make a living as a race car driver? However, you know, whatever discipline, his ultimate goal is, I'm just going to be paid to be a race car driver. What kind of advice or path do you put him on?
I think there's a couple things that I look back, I would say maybe three things. So the first one is always surround yourself with good people. No matter what situation you're in, you have to have good people around you. No matter how good of a race car driver you are, you have to have people that are smarter than you around you. Like I said, it doesn't matter how talented you are. The people that are building the equipment, whether it's your dad, right, whether it's, you know, you hire somebody to do it, or it, whatever the case may be, you have to surround yourself with good people, and good things will typically happen. And, you know, I look at the race teams that I've been around that have been successful, and the race teams that I've been around that haven't. If every time I've been around what I felt a really good race team, we've been successful. And the second one I'll say is I've always lived by this quote. I'm not sure if somebody came up with it before me, but I'm sure somebody has. But I always live by, right when you think you're the best is exactly when you're going to get beat. So I've always lived by that, especially on my late model side, because you know how it is when you hit on something in racing and you're maybe ahead of your competition. It's so hard to keep that edge. And, you know, I feel like I've been pretty successful on the late model side for a long time. And the way we go about it is we never just settle on something and run that package out until it isn't anymore. When we feel like, geez, okay, this team's starting to get a little better, this team's starting to get a little better, we've got to stay ahead of it. And, you know, so that's kind of a quote that I've always lived by. And I feel like it's, you know, the mentality, if you can have that mentality and not get, you know, cocky and always think that you can learn something when you go to the racetrack and always think that you can be better, you will continue to be better. And right when you have the mentality that you have it all figured out, that's probably when somebody's going to pass you up.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. It's endless. You know, it's one of those endless sports, just like, you know, the average guy can think about golf. Like it is, you can be a student of the game forever and then add in the complexity of dealing with a race car, not just the act of driving it, you know?
Yeah, no doubt.
There's a lot of components there. Man, I appreciate you coming on. Anything else to tell the folks? You're heading into your next full season. Just working in the shop. You out on, you snowmobiling at all?
Man, you know, it's funny. I used to be a huge snowmobiler. I still am. But once I got this, you know, once I got to Thor Sport and I got this really good opportunity, I've been a little bit gun shy to go snowmobiling because you can't control. I just see horror stories. And so I haven't gone because I really don't want to get myself hurt, because when I get out on the trail and the snowmobile's handling good, I just can't control myself. I have to go. Like, I'm out of control. And I do mostly trail riding. So I got adjustable shocks and I got bump stops on my snowmobile. So we're making adjustments on them, making them handle good. Like, that's the fun that we have when we go, right? It's not looking at the scenery. We're working on our snowmobile like a race car, right? So anyways, we get out of control. We haul ass through the woods, and I just didn't want something to happen to where I hindered my opportunity at racing full time the following season. So when I get a little bit older and I simmer down a little bit, I'll get back behind the snowmobile.
Good. Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah, man. I appreciate it. I guess tell people where they can find you. You're kind of an old school guy. You're only on Twitter.
Yeah, just Twitter, and I got a Facebook page that I don't run. So if you really want to get a hold of me personally, Twitter is the one.
Right on. Well, thanks for coming on, man, and good luck. We're rooting for you.
Yeah, man, appreciate it. Good talking to you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, take care. If you guys enjoyed this, give me a rating and share it with some friends.